Welcome, everyone. Welcome. Oh, my goodness. What a glorious day it has been, right? You are listening to Steele Talk, and I am your host, Geralyn Steele. It is what I love to do on a Sunday night is to be here with you. And it's been 23 years, glorious years. Yes, there were ups and downs, but it comes with everything that we try to do in our lives, right? So, yeah, it's been quite an amazing run. I would love to say that I am so really happy that Jonathan is back. Yeah, Jonathan Lowe is back, but I can't say it. His hair will blow up. I mean, literally blow up. So I just don't know if I should say it, but let's just try it. Hey, Jonathan, we missed you so much.
I don't know what you're talking about. I'm very even keel. I am just a ball of humility.
Oh, lies and slander. Your bow tie stands up when you wear it.
Bow tie.
Because
bow
tie.
I'm not the bow tie person. That is one Dan Cook at this station. He is the bow tie guy.
That's right. Dan Cook, man. He does not play around.
No, he doesn't. Not when it comes to his bow ties. He does not.
Well, I have to start out by saying thank you to you as one of my producers, as well as Craig Schofer and Chris Tubbs. Thank you all for doing a great job. And by the way, Twins baseball returns tomorrow as they travel to Cleveland to take on the Guardians. Pre-game show is at 5:30 p.m. with a 6:10 first pitch right here on WCCO. Okay, Jonathan, how are the Twins doing? I have not had a chance to listen in.
They are doing well. They won today over Colorado and won that series. And now they have Cleveland after coming in earlier this week, winning a couple of games, and getting a leg up on the Twins. They really took some hits this week against Boston this weekend. And so now the Twins are back on top of the division. And now that series in Cleveland is a humongous one. Even at this time of the year, there's still 3 months left in the season. But at this time of the year, to go to Cleveland. It's a five-game series because they're playing a doubleheader, I believe, on Tuesday. So that means that if they can win 3 of 5 or 4 of 5, they can really stretch that lead out a little bit more again. So it's a big series.
Okay. So I got to ask you real quickly, Mikkelsen, what is his first name again? Phil Mikkelsen, the golfer, right?
Oh, Mikkelsen.
Mikkelsen, thank you. I thought it was Mikkelsen. I'm amazed at this whole thing that has started over this Saudi golf league that was happening. It's a really big deal, and they've been talking about it, what now, for 2 months or something? Because they knew he signed on and said, yes, 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 I'm coming to Saudi Arabia. So what is the latest on that?
So the tour, he's not playing in Saudi Arabia. On this tour, there's 8 stops. One of them is in Saudi Arabia, but the rest of them are across the planet. The first one was in London a couple of weeks ago. The next one will be this next weekend, and there are 4 events that are scheduled to be hosted in the United States, and this is going to be the first of those events. It's in Portland, Oregon. So there are 3 more. There'll be 3 more in the United States. There's one, there's one in Asia, and I can't remember off the top of my head where these are.
Mm-hmm.
But the big thing about this league that's been formed, it's not that there's something that is different or it's a new thing or it's a competitor to the PGA Tour, which is really the first big competitor it's seen in its history. Mm. It's the backer of the league. It's the fact that the Saudi Arabian government is basically backing this league. And so people are taking issue with, okay, if you're taking money from an entity that has been formed and is funded, fully funded, by the Saudi government, you should have an idea of what their human rights record is. And people will talk about how the PGA Tour not only gives permission for players to go play a Saudi Arabian tournament or two, or places like Qatar or the United Arab Emirates. They talk about the PGA's relationship with China. They talk about the NBA's relationship with China. The relationship in the past with places like Russia. The difference there is that there's a relationship there that should be, in many ways, be scrutinized. and it shouldn't be just thrown under the table. But this is different when you have a government fully backing, fully funding an entity. And that's what this is. And that's why people are they're causing a stink, such a big stink about it. There are other people.
Well, they're causing a stink is because he keeps saying things that people don't like him saying. He's been trying to, you know, when this first started, this first came out, he was the one that kept changing the narrative. You know, he would say one thing, oh no, 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 and I'm really no, no. I mean, he was almost stuttering. He didn't quite know what to say to particularly the press.
Well,
It
all started with a comment that he made to an author of a book that came out recently that kind of chronicled Mickelson's career. And Mickelson talked about how, you know, these are bad dudes. These are bad people that we're taking money from. And we know that they've committed human rights atrocities. We know that they were behind the murder of an American journalist. But yet, you know, sometimes maybe you got to take the blood money. That's paraphrasing what he said. And that's when everybody started to hound him for this. And it completely disrupted his career. He went MIA.
Right.
For about 4 months, missed the Masters, which he loves, which he's a multiple-time champion. Mm-hmm. He skipped the PGA Championship, which he won last year, mind you. He was the defending champion, and he won it at age 50, making him the oldest man to ever win a PGA Tour major. And he missed out on the opportunity to take in all that love and affection and just completely skipped it. And then the next time he came out of whatever hiding he came out of was for this LIV Golf Tour. And so this is really – it's really created a divide in the world of golf and between the golf fandom.
Right.
It's really created some sort of divide between everybody that follows the game.
Was he the one that insulted Tiger Woods by saying, oh, God, now that he's in the Masters, we're going to have fried chicken and
No.
Who was that?
No. That was what we like, what some people like call an old head by the name of Fuzzy Zeller. That was Fuzzy Zeller.
Oh, Fuzzy Zeller. Yeah. But Mickelson, didn't he use a bad word or a negative word towards Tiger Woods?
No.
An offensive word?
No. He's never been one to do that. There have been other people that are older that are on the senior tour, the Champions Tour now, or just plain retired. It was older folks that were saying these things mostly. Maybe David Duval said something that wasn't too flattering. Mickelson has not done that because he knew that Tiger was good for the game. He knew that Tiger was going to be his main rival. He knew he had to step up and beat Tiger head-to-head to get any sort of credibility. So he's never been, as far as I know, derogatory in his words toward Tiger Woods.
Okay. Thank you for correcting me on that. I sure appreciate it. All right. Another thing I want to talk about is the G7, but we're going to take a break and then come back in just a moment. Stay tuned. Welcome back, everyone. Thank you so much for sticking and staying with us here at WCCO. You are listening to Steele Talk, and I'm your host, Geraldine Steele. It's 7:21. And, of course, it's time to talk about the G7. That is happening today. It started today, and it's going all the way through Tuesday, I believe. And this summit is really important this year. Our President Biden urges the Western unity on Ukraine amid war fatigue. Oh, man. Yeah, so many people are absolutely fatigued with all of the war, with all of the madness that is happening from country to country. What's interesting is that you look at this round table of leaders, this G7, and they are really powerful. Let's just put it that way to make it very clear. And then you look at who is involved in this group of seven leaders. They wanted to announce new bans on imports of Russian gold, the latest in a series of sanctions. The Club of Democracies hopes will further isolate Russia economically. Now, they also were looking at possible price caps on energy meant to limit Russian oil and gas profits that Moscow can pump into its war effort. What's amazing about this group is that it's all men except for one. One woman is a part of this, and when you really read about her or find out who she is or why she's there, I get so frustrated. I don't know. It feels like we are all going backwards. Women are being chased. It's like they're trying to chase us backwards. You know, when we came and heard yesterday, in fact, on Friday, what the Supreme Court did about Roe versus Wade, I don't understand. Why in the world specifically do men have to get in our business? Why do they have to get all up in our stuff, you know, going all into our private parts, you know, just while they're sitting at home thinking about it or sitting at home reading it or sitting at home deciding that they're going to change something really big in women's lives and they're going to take over our lives. Well, there was one woman yesterday, Jonathan, and she was out there protesting and she said something, and I can't remember the whole thing, but she had one sign that said, you know, we're going to make sure that vasectomies are done on every man. And maybe some people think that's really funny, but seriously, if we got in their stuff while they're in our stuff, maybe somebody's stuff will finally drop off and we'll get clarity. I don't understand it. I will never understand why men want to get in our business. Leave our private parts alone. Just leave us alone. We have the right to make our own decisions, period. Now, I don't know about you, Jonathan. If someone says to you, okay, you have to have a vasectomy immediately, you cannot help bring children into this world. What would you say?
I would say exactly what you're saying. I would say, hands off my business. Figuratively and in many other cases. And if I'm not hurting anyone, if I'm not harming anyone on the outside, then what is the difference to me? Or what is the difference to you? Now, this is where it gets tricky because, again, this all goes to when does life start?
Right.
And I've been listening to different people talking about this from the pro-choice side, from the pro-life side, all weekend. And it's just one of those issues where we are going to be so divided on agreement on this issue that I don't know if it'll ever get solved. And
I'm not even asking if it's going to get solved. What I'm saying is, why is it that your, you know, men, just constantly keep coming after us?
Because
right?
we think we know it all and we think we have every right to the power.
But it's quite evident that you don't know. That you don't know it all.
I am just giving you the thought process behind it. Really,
no,
there's no other logical explanation other than that. Other than
This is
thought to be a patriarchal society. Not just here in the United States, but in many countries around the world. It's thought to be patriarchal first. The men do the hunting. The men do the gathering. The men fight the wars. The men have the power. The men make the decisions. And whether it is right or wrong, whether it's logical, which I don't believe it's logical, mm-hmm. I think that is where you get that mindset. Is there's a term out there that you hear all the time now called mansplaining.
Yeah.
When you have a man explaining things and doing it in a degrading way or a downgrading way to women. You don't have a women-splaining. You don't have a woman-splaining term out there. You don't.
You know what my biggest concern is, Jonathan? Is that because of medications and the way our food is processed, you know, so many people have allergies to the food that we eat. And I'm looking at young girls, 10, 11, 12, 13 years old, who are having their period much earlier than my generation ever did, right? And I worry about them. What happens if they are raped? You know, or incest or whatever. Well, that's still like rape. So I why in the world would we not consider every type of woman when it comes to her making a choice or that's her parents been, helping to make the choice.
You don't
it's
know
like they're
how
not
many
considering
times,
it.
I don't know if you know how many times that question has been asked to people on the pro-life side of this entire weekend. And I'm sure it's been asked to people over the last, especially over the last 5 years since Donald Trump got into office. There, once he got into office, there was the likelihood that he would be replacing Supreme Court justices. And now we fast forward to this weekend, the number of people, pro-life people I've seen that have been asked this question about, what if a 12-year-old gets raped? Are you telling us that that girl should take that out to term? And the amount of ducking and dodging the answer, I mean, you're looking at, I don't know if the former president could have done that ducking and dodging any better. There were very few clear, distinct answers to that, and they just continue to duck and dodge answering that question.
Well, all I'm saying, if you're going to take the rights from women, then you must take the rights from men, period. You don't get to just decide that a woman has to have a child. It sounds like The Handmaid's Tale, right? It's like the TV program, the movie, whatever it is. What was it? A series,
it,
right?
It was a book that was made into a series, and I believe it's still ongoing. I think this is the last season of it.
Yeah, and it didn't work out in the book, and it didn't work out in the movie. I mean, I'm just trying to figure out, what is this madness? We are grown folk. These are women you're talking about, fully grown women, bright, smart, strong, caring. And all of a sudden, you say, oh, no, you can't do any of that. We get to tell you what you can do. And now they're going after, you know, the pills. To say you can't even take the pills to stop you from getting pregnant. So who exactly are they going after? They're not going after people of color. They're not going after black people saying we need you to have more babies. There used to be a time when I was going down 94 to St. Cloud, and there were all of these huge billboards, right, that would say this baby is, you know, once the child is acknowledged, then that is a baby. That is a child. That's a baby. It's a child right then and there. And it's not. You can't take that child out of a woman and that child, you know, cries and opens their eyes and say, Mom, you know, it doesn't work that way. It's so frustrating to me. So then I say, if you're going to stay in our stuff, we're going to have to either get into your stuff or we're going to have to get out of your stuff. Hint, hint. Okay, we're going to take a break. We'll be back. Welcome back, everyone. It is now 7:36 here at WCCO. I'm your host, Geralyn Steele. I love this song, Jonathan. It brings joy, man. I'm just smiling. Well, this interview, our first interview tonight, I'm telling you, this is really important, you guys, because I hear it so often from friends, from neighbors, from people in grocery stores or at parks. And it's kind of sad. You know, the best and worst places for first-time home buyers in 2022, there's an article about it. And it says here, in the COVID-fueled real estate boom, home prices continue hitting new highs. Soaring values are a windfall for homeowners, but a headache for first-time homebuyers, who can be forgiven for feeling as though home ownership moves further out of reach by the week. Well, joining us to talk about this and to really take a look at what states are doing well, what cities are doing well when it comes to home buyers moving in and what they're looking for, that sort of thing. Jeff Ostrowski, I hope I said that correctly. He's from bankrate.com. He's an analyst, and he is joining us to talk about this new study that has come out. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm great, and I enjoyed your interpretation of my story there. That was better than I could have read it myself.
Well, thank you very much. This is really important that we have this right now because Americans are frustrated around the country. Those that thought, hey, I've owned a couple of homes, I can do it again. You know, I just need to make sure that the price is just right. And people are foregoing making sure they get an inspector in to check out the house, which I think is ridiculous and kind of crazy. But here we are talking about real estate again. Remember when we the mortgage crisis that happened in 2007, was a nightmare. And here we are now looking at a different type of nightmare. Am I correct?
Yeah, you're right. And I do remember those days well when we had a housing boom from 05 to 07 and then a crash. And I remember thinking, I guess we won't have to worry about affordability again. I mean, affordability issues aren't really going to hit the U.S. housing market anymore. And instead, as you just mentioned, we've got home prices soaring and affordability is really an issue.
It's a big, huge issue. And every city is so different, right? But in the cities where we expect low prices, even those small cities, right, or small towns are finding that it just keeps going up and up. So people are saying, oh, yeah, I'm going to move, you know, down south to some little tiny suburb. And then they find out it's as expensive there. You know, so what
right.
do you do?
Yeah. And this so unlike the previous housing boom of 15 years ago, when it was really just a few cities or a few areas around the country that really were experiencing the boom. Places like California and Phoenix and Las Vegas and Florida. And then really a lot of the Midwestern markets, a lot of the markets in the interior of the U.S. didn't see huge price spikes. And the opposite happened since COVID. So we've seen double-digit increases in home prices everywhere. So even in places like Cleveland and Detroit that typically hadn't seen significant appreciation in home prices. So you're right, it's happening everywhere. And of course, most workers' paychecks aren't going up by double digits. They're going up, but not that much. And so it's just really difficult for buyers, and especially for first-time buyers. So repeat buyers have the luxury of the cushion of all that equity they've built up. So it's if you're selling one house and buying another, yeah, it's not an ideal time to be buying, but you know, nobody's going to cry too many tears for somebody who just cashed in $100,000 in home price gains and they're rolling it over into another place. But for people who are renters now, it's very difficult because the home prices are at record highs. And so that it's just tougher than it's ever been to save up a down payment, to qualify for a mortgage, to clear all those hurdles you need to get over to buy a home.
All right. So then tell me, why did you decide to do the study on first time home buyers? Because to me, it looks as though we're all suffering with this, with trying to buy a home, whether you've had several homes or one home before and you owned it. It seems to be, you know, an equal balance. So why first time home buyers?
Well, a lot of it is that dynamic that I just described where I've owned my house for 20 years, or if I'm an older Gen Xer or a baby boomer, the chances are I've been living in my house for a long time, and I've really built up a lot of equity thanks to this boom here in the past few years. And so if that's my situation, I can sell, cash out, and I can take that money from the sale and use it for a down payment on the next place. But first-time buyers don't have that luxury. They don't have that cushion. And so it's just a really difficult market for them. And for people who really value homeownership, it might make sense to consider moving somewhere that's more affordable. And so that was what really was the impetus for this, that we've got a large population of millennials who are in their prime home buying years. That generation is even bigger than the baby boom. And so there are a lot of Americans out there in their late 20s and their 30s who want to buy a house and are really, you know, faced with a challenging market right now.
Well, let's jump right in because, of course, we want to know the best and worst places for the first time home buyers for this year. Where do we start?
Well, and so best and worst, I guess, you know, might not be the most precise descriptor, even though that's what we called it. It's probably like the most challenging and least challenging markets. But so for the worst markets, it's sort of the places you'd expect. Los Angeles came in number 50 in our analysis of the 50 largest metro areas. And that's just because homes there are so unaffordable compared to incomes. At the other end of the scale, number one was Pittsburgh, and that's for the opposite reason. Homes there are very affordable in relation to incomes. And Minneapolis came in at number two among the top 50 metro areas, and it was for a combination of factors. The affordability dynamics are pretty good there. I was a little surprised to see how high incomes are in Minneapolis for the age group that we looked at. So for 25 to 44-year-olds, the median income in the Minneapolis metro area is more than $91,000 a year, according to the Census Bureau. And so that's high. I mean, that's similar to New York. That's higher than Denver or San Diego or Portland. So even though Minneapolis is not a super cheap market in raw terms, it's for people who are making a local wage, it's actually a fairly affordable market. And so that was one of the big factors. And Minneapolis also did very well in the homeownership rate among local residents ages 25 to 44. And I'm assuming that's partly because of that this high incomes for millennials and for younger Gen Xers in your metro area.
Yeah. You know, I'm curious about Kansas. They have grown a lot over the years, over the last three decades for sure. And I'm just curious, where do they land in this?
Let's see. So Kansas City?
Mm-hmm.
All right, you're
Oh, wait, I see it.
Find it.
No, I see it. No, I see it. Okay. The Kansas City metro area ranked number one in market tightness or lack thereof in this category.
Correct.
What does that mean?
Okay, so the market tightness was just a way of measuring how difficult it's going to be for a buyer looking for a house in any given market. So we just looked at a couple of metrics. One is days on market, so how quickly homes are selling. And then another metric around just how long it takes to buy.
Welcome back, everyone. It is now 7:36 here at WCCO. I'm your host, Geraldine Steele. I love this song, Jonathan. It brings joy, man. I'm just smiling. Well, this interview, our first interview tonight, I'm telling you, this is really important, you guys, because I hear it so often from friends, from neighbors, from people in grocery stores or at parks. And it's kind of sad. You know, the best and worst places for first-time home buyers in 2022, there's an article about it. And it says here, in the COVID-fueled real estate boom, home prices continue hitting new highs. Soaring values are a windfall for homeowners, but a headache for first-time homebuyers, who can be forgiven for feeling as though home ownership moves further out of reach by the week. Well, joining us to talk about this and to really take a look at what states are doing well, what cities are doing well when it comes to home buyers moving in and what they're looking for, that sort of thing. Jeff Ostrowski, I hope I said that correctly. He's from bankrate.com. He's an analyst, and he is joining us to talk about this new study that has come out. How you doing, Jeff?
I'm great, and I enjoyed your interpretation of my story there. That was better than I could have read it myself.
Well, thank you very much. This is really important that we have this right now because Americans are frustrated around the country. Those that thought, hey, I've owned a couple of homes, I can do it again. You know, I just need to make sure that the price is just right. And people are foregoing, making sure they get an inspector in to check out the house, which I think is ridiculous and kind of crazy. But here we are talking about real estate again. Remember when the mortgage crisis that happened in 2007, was a nightmare. And here we are now looking at a different type of nightmare. Am I correct?
Yeah, you're right. And I do remember those days well when we had a housing boom from 05 to 07 and then a crash. And I remember thinking, I guess we won't have to worry about affordability again. And affordability issues aren't really going to hit the U.S. housing market anymore. And instead, as you just mentioned, we've got home prices soaring and affordability is really an issue.
It's a big, huge issue. And every city is so different, right? But in the cities where we expect low prices, even those small cities, right, or small towns are finding that it just keeps going up and up. So people are saying, oh, yeah, I'm going to move, you know, down south to some little tiny suburb. And then they find out it's as expensive there. You know, so what do you do?
Yeah, and this, so unlike the previous housing boom of 15 years ago, when it was really just a few cities or a few areas around the country that really were experiencing the boom, places like California and Phoenix and Las Vegas and Florida, and then really a lot of the Midwestern markets, a lot of the markets in the interior of the U.S. didn't see huge price spikes. And the opposite happened since COVID. So we've seen double-digit increases in home prices everywhere. So even in places like Cleveland and Detroit that typically hadn't seen significant appreciation in home prices. So you're right, it's happening everywhere. And of course, most workers' paychecks aren't going up by double digits. They're going up, but not that much. And so it's just really difficult for buyers, and especially for first-time buyers. So repeat buyers have the luxury of the cushion of all that equity they've built up. So it's if you're selling one house and buying another, yeah, it's not an ideal time to be buying, but you know, nobody's going to cry too many tears for somebody who just cashed in $100,000 in home price gains and they're rolling it over into another place. But for people who are renters now, it's very difficult because the home prices are at record highs, and so that it's just tougher than it's ever been to save up a down payment, to qualify for a mortgage, to clear all those hurdles you need to get over to buy a home.
All right. So then tell me, why did you decide to do the study on first-time home buyers? Because to me, it looks as though we're all suffering with this, with trying to buy a home, whether you've had several homes or one home before and you owned it. It seems to be, you know, an equal balance. So why first-time home buyers?
Well, a lot of it is that dynamic that I just described where I've owned my house for 20 years, or if I'm an older Gen Xer or a baby boomer, the chances are I've been living in my house for a long time, and I've really built up a lot of equity thanks to this boom here in the past few years. And so if that's my situation, I can sell, cash out, and I can take that money from the sale and use it for a down payment on the next place. But first-time buyers don't have that luxury. They don't have that cushion. And so it's just a really difficult market for them. And for people who really value homeownership, it might make sense to consider moving somewhere that's more affordable. And so that was what really was the impetus for this, that we've got a large population of millennials who are in their prime home buying years. That generation is even bigger than the baby boom. And so there are a lot of Americans out there in their late 20s and their 30s who want to buy a house and are really, you know, faced with a challenging market right now.
Well, let's jump right in, because, of course, we want to know the best and worst places for the first time home buyers for this year. Where do we start?
Well, and so best and worst, I guess, you know, might not be the most precise descriptor, even though that's what we called it. It's probably like the most challenging and least challenging markets. But so for the worst markets, it's sort of the places you'd expect. Los Angeles came in number 50 in our analysis of the 50 largest metro areas. And that's just because homes there are so unaffordable compared to incomes. At the other end of the scale, number one was Pittsburgh, and that's for the opposite reason. Homes there are very affordable in relation to incomes. And Minneapolis came in at number two among the top 50 metro areas, and it was for a combination of factors. The affordability dynamics are pretty good there. I was a little surprised to see how high incomes are in Minneapolis for the age group that we looked at. So for 25 to 44-year-olds, the median income in the Minneapolis metro area is more than $91,000 a year, according to the Census Bureau. And so that's high. I mean, that's similar to New York. That's higher than Denver or San Diego or Portland. So even though Minneapolis is not a super cheap market in raw terms, it's for people who are making a local wage, it's actually a fairly affordable market. And so that was one of the big factors. And Minneapolis also did very well in the homeownership rate among local residents ages 25 to 44. And I'm assuming that's partly because of that this high incomes for millennials and for younger Gen Xers in your metro area.
Yeah. You know, I'm curious about Kansas. They have grown a lot over the years, over the last three decades for sure. And I'm just curious, where did they land in this?
Let's see. So Kansas City?
Mm-hmm.
All right,
I see it. The Kansas City metro area ranked number one in market tightness or lack thereof in this category.
Correct.
What does that mean?
Okay, so the market tightness was just a way of measuring how difficult it's going to be for a buyer looking for a house in any given market. So we just looked at a couple of metrics. One is days on market, so how quickly homes are selling. And then another metric around just how long it takes to buy a home. I'm drawing a blank on which other metric we used. It was the inventory. So change in inventory over the past year. And so Kansas City was really the softest market. As you were just describing, we've got a crazy market nationally where buyers are being forced to do all these things like waive inspection contingencies, waive appraisal contingencies. And so this ranking, we looked at these two metrics to just figure out where buyers might be least likely to face those kinds of challenges. And so Kansas City was the easiest market for buyers. Minneapolis was sort of in the middle of the pack. It's just a tough market everywhere. Basically in every metro area in the country, there's a shortage of supply and more buyers than there are sellers.
I'm a little surprised to see Buffalo on here. It says the metro area placed in the top 10 in affordability and housing market tightness. So once again, tightness. And when you look at that, the people in Buffalo, are they making enough to buy to purchase the homes?
Yeah, they are. And it's not that in the case of Buffalo, it's a sort of a different story from Minneapolis. So it's not that incomes are quite as high among young adults in Buffalo as they are in Minneapolis, but Buffalo home prices are just really low. And so that was a driver for Pittsburgh, for Buffalo. Just very low prices. The median home price in the first quarter of this year for Buffalo was $185,000, whereas in Minneapolis it was $325,000. And so in a few of these markets, you know, places like St. Louis and Cleveland and Detroit and Louisville and Birmingham, Alabama, Memphis as well, I mean, those are all very inexpensive markets. And so for somebody who's really struggling to afford a house, maybe one of those metro areas would be a place to consider.
Let's quickly talk about the bottom five metros for first-time homebuyers. I mean, I was so surprised to see Seattle on here.
Yeah, Seattle has had an extreme shortage of housing. It's one of the tech markets on the West Coast where the prices have just soared because you've got a small number of very high-paid workers, people working at Microsoft and Amazon and other tech companies who are cashing in stock options, and they want to live there in a tech hub. And so those folks have the ability to pay, and so that's one of the markets where home prices are just really being bid up because of the strength of the local tech economy. And it's kind of a similar situation in Silicon Valley and in San Francisco as well.
You know, trying to get a mortgage has been such a challenge for so many people because the game has changed. The game has changed. And it feels as though most people that are really trying, and I would say the middle class, that keep trying to buy a house, but they know that since the rules have changed, like, oh, well, you have great credit and, oh, you sound great, but, you know, you really need to get a better job and maybe make a little more money for about 2 or 4 years, and then we can talk about this. I mean, you start to hear these things, knowing from, like, even bankers, it's like, how in the world are we ever going to get ahead when trying to find a home?
Well, yeah, that's the challenge of this big run-up we've had in home prices over the past 2 years. I mean, not that it was easy to qualify for a mortgage before COVID, but I mean, we've had 20% a year home price appreciation for a couple of years now. And incomes just haven't gone up that much, especially for first-time buyers. And so it's just it's gotten really tough for buyers to qualify. I mean, there are programs like the FHA loan, the Federal Housing Administration mortgage program, that does allow borrowers to qualify with just 3.5% down and with the credit scores as low as maybe 630 or 640. So that is an option, but of course the income challenge that you mentioned isn't going to be solved by an FHA loan, because if you just don't have enough income to qualify, you're still not going to qualify. So that's part of the reason that we did this study, just to help people have a little more information about where they might be able to go to stretch their housing dollar a bit farther and hopefully boost their chances of qualifying for a mortgage.
Last question. If they don't get to buy homes, then what happens? What happens to people? The rent is severely high in many of these cities that you've talked about. So where do we go next? How do we know where to turn in order to get a loan?
Right. So, yeah, the rent is a huge challenge, and that's really feeding into this affordability crisis, because if your rent's going up 15% to 20% a year, that's really eroding your ability to save for a down payment and just get your finances in order to be able to buy. I would say that homeownership is not the only way to economic security, but it is a very important part for most Americans. It's a way to build wealth and to have some certainty around your month-to-month and year-to-year housing expenses. There's a very long answer to that question, but I guess the short answer would be it's very difficult in high-priced markets. It can be done, though, by cobbling together some things like down payment assistance, first-time homebuyer assistance, and then looking for some workarounds, like maybe buying a fixer-upper or being willing to move farther out and maybe have a longer commute.
Mm. Well, the fixer-uppers are even way more expensive than I think they should be. So there we go. But Jeff Ostrosko, thank you so much for joining us tonight. He's with Bankrate.com. He's an analyst, and he is joining us on the John Schuster Caldwell Banker Hotline. Thank you so much, Jeff. I hope we can talk with you again.
Great. Thanks for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you. All right, everyone. I learned a lot, and it's quite a study. If you get a chance to check it out, I'm going to see if I can find that link where you can get this, because it's really quite remarkable what is happening. We're going to take a break. We'll be back. It is now 7:57, and I tell you, I wanted to make sure you knew that also when it comes to buying a home, people are concerned about wellness and culture. They are concerned about safety and so much more. So stay tuned. I'm going to try and find that website so that you can find out where they got it from and where you can access it as well. Now, coming up next, my next guest in the 8 o'clock hour is Corey Gordon. He's a lawyer, and we're going to talk a little bit about global racial reckoning. We'll be back in just a moment. It is now 7:57, and I tell you, I wanted to make sure you knew that also when it comes to buying a home, people are concerned about wellness and culture. They are concerned about safety and so much more. So stay tuned. I'm going to try and find that website so that you can find out where they got it from and where you can access it as well. Now, coming up next, my next guest in the 8 o'clock hour is Corey Gordon. He's a lawyer, and we're going to talk a little bit about global racial reckoning. We'll be back in just a moment.